You know, if you're our generation, you get asked, what made you decide to be a philosopher? Or how did you get to be a philosopher? Now, that's a politer way of saying maybe, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? Yeah. Or how did you get from a town of 20,000 people in the middle of Illinois to the academy? And there's actually a short answer. There were two, you know, very small colleges in my town, McMurry College and Illinois College. I had good friends whose parents, fathers, were teaching there. I hung around their houses, lots of books. I liked it, you know. And my own dad would have given anything to have been a professor rather than a contractor. He thought, God, it's the life. You sit and read books. I didn't have a heart to tell him how much we don't sit and read books. I didn't mention committees or anything, you know. But my parents did both tell me that I could do anything I wanted and I should do anything I wanted. But my dad did warn me I was going to have to work twice as hard. He had much more sense of history than I did. He said, Anne's a Lucy Stoner. And I said, who's Lucy Stone? So you can Google her if you're not good at history either. I had a history teacher in ninth grade who thought, he said, you should consider being a history professor. And then when I got to Monmouth College, where I went simply because they gave me the most aid, two people there encouraged me to keep going in philosophy. My primary mentor, Sam Thompson, and the guy 2 years older than me who became my first husband, who was also a philosophy major named Bill Winslade. In fact, I probably switched my major from history to philosophy so I could out-argue Bill. It's good motivation. But so that's the short answer, and then I persevered. One thing that did not encourage me to go to grad school in philosophy was the first course I ever had in it, which was in high school. There was a guy at McMurry College named Leroy Garrett who had gotten a grant to teach an intro course in the high school in my town, Jacksonville. The class was all girls, because it was opposite physics and all the smart boys took physics. So, and I thought the people we read were lunatics who had unreasonable views that people just shouldn't hold. We read Plato, Descartes, and Nietzsche. Those are the ones I remember. I thought they were crazy. I don't know who else we read. I probably liked whoever else it was okay. But I never dreamed I'd end up teaching this subject. As we see my whole life. Oh, in case you're calculating, if I were sitting there, I'd be calculating, how old is she? 79. So then, because I was getting married immediately after college in 1965, I applied only to the University of Chicago and Northwestern because by then husband, Bill, was at Northwestern. Now, Northwestern and Chicago admitted me, but Northwestern's dean put in writing that he did not fund women, you know, students. This was after the Civil Rights Act, not a long time. It was just the year before, but it was after the Civil Rights Act. Chappelle actually convinced me to come to Chicago in part. They also gave me money. That helped. By saying that Northwestern was out of the mainstream. Well, I had no clue whether I wanted to be in the mainstream because my undergraduate education was pretty much historical. And the last works I had read, in terms of time, I'd read Language, Truth, and Logic and something of Sartre. I knew nothing about the mainstream, you know. But I was lucky, it was very lucky actually, that I was at Chicago. There was a lot of misogyny at Northwestern. They had a few women who often left. Bill Earle and Bill Eady, who were, you know, already senior people, were terrible misogynists. And so It was a good thing that they didn't give me money and I went to Chicago. We had women students at Chicago, not a lot, but some. The regular faculty members were all men, but they were pretty nice men. And some women did teach there, you know, off and on. In the fall of 65, Elizabeth Anscombe came for a term. Suzanne McCormick Thalberg had an appointment in the college, some kind of humanities appointment. But she got to teach a course on Hume to us, which I took. And it was there, actually, that I first realized that Hume wasn't evidently talking about women until the chapter on chastity. I didn't know that until I got to chastity. I was pissed. I read it, all those other chapters. Yeah. So, sorry, I'm having a little trouble reading this. McCormick Thalberg was the first professor with whom I had a conversation between the stalls of the ladies' room. And then when we were washing our hands, she told me I was, unlike some of the women grad students, and I didn't need hand-holding. And I thought at the time that was a compliment because, you know, you'd think like a man at that time was a compliment. In hindsight, I think I did need hand-holding. I was just taught to tough things out. That occurred to me this afternoon, Susan. But it was culture shock at Chicago to me. It was the heyday of analytic philosophy. I signed up for a course. I began in summer. So June in Chicago was really nice, but I signed up for a course in epistemology that turned out to be completely an ordinary language analysis of the difference between lying and being mistaken. I thought I had changed fields completely. Well, I had changed fields completely. But every Tuesday we had to turn in a paper. So by Sunday night, I was like this, and it was horrible. But I did it. And then in the fall, I took Anscombe's course, which I think was on pleasure. I can't find the notes. And I've emailed some of the people that were in the class, and they haven't answered yet. So I hope they're okay. But I hadn't read Wittgenstein yet. So it was interesting. I took notes dutifully. But the next quarter, I had a course on the later Wittgenstein taught by Bob Coburn. And I loved Wittgenstein. I loved the course. I loved Coburn. But I later came to realize that his teaching style of writing all of Wittgenstein's arguments in the form of modus ponens up on the blackboard probably wouldn't be something Wittgenstein liked. So I got my MA at Chicago in 66. We took exams at the end of the year. You took the same exams for both the MA level and the PhD level. There were 72 people who took those exams. Can you imagine a program like that now? Two people out of 72 got the pass at the PhD level. Not many of the people out of those 72 ever got a degree, either at Chicago or somewhere else. There were a lot of unhappy people, but I, by then, was not an unhappy person. I liked it. I liked the department, and I felt very much at home in analytic philosophy, but my then husband, Bill, was on the job market. And we just hoped, you could hope in 1966 that you'd get offers at PhD programs. I mean, you could still hope that then. And he got two offers, one from Maryland, and one, if we had gone to Buffalo, I would have met you then. No, you would have come just after that.
I came in 67.
Well, I would have gone in 66. But
you would have taught me.
But in any case, we really picked the university. Well, he picked it. It was his job, but we picked D.C. area over going to Buffalo. I mean, just because it's going to be more fun, and it was fun. And of course, the politics of the late 60s in D.C. were amazingly exciting. I didn't even apply to any place else. I didn't want to commute. I'd done that for a while in Chicago, and I did not want to do it. But you might think it'd be awkward being a faculty couple, like the faculty member and the grad student. But it really wasn't. I was very well treated in each category. It was, well, it was a very heterosexual, couple-y kind of place, so the faculty and their wives did a lot of social things together. And they treated the women grad students pretty well, because we actually were the best ones they had. In fact, they used to joke that they thought they'd admit only women because all the ones that were the best ones were women. But it's not an accident, because we were tied to men in the DC area. So, that's how things happen. There was a lot of political activity in the late 60s, but it didn't hit philosophy. When I was deciding,
Buffalo philosophy in
68 already, because that's when I was deciding on a topic for my dissertation. I never considered anything that was feminist. I was already interested in philosophical methods and such, but it seemed so abstract and I didn't know what I'd do with it. And I had, Maryland used to have a lot of visitors from the UK, and I used to love their courses. I'd written a paper on mental images for Errol Bedford that he thought was publishable. And so I wasn't sure where it was going to lead, so I wrote on visualizing. That's what I ended up doing. I mean, it wasn't called visualizing by the authors I was writing on. It was called imagination and Ryle and imaging sometimes in Wittgenstein and a lot of other things. I also included a chapter on Armstrong and some cognitive psychologists. I lucked out with my dissertation advisor because Moreland Perkins, who had just published a book on perception, had just come to Maryland, and he'd been teaching at an undergraduate college, so he hadn't had dissertations to read. He would turn a chapter around overnight, and the first chapter he let me turn in, it was handwritten. I mean, for those of you who are really young, we didn't have computers yet. The hardest chapter I wrote was on the cognitive psychologist, because I wrote it just after I wrote the chapter on Wittgenstein, and I knew that Wittgenstein was turning over in his grave by what the cognitive psychologists were doing. If he could, he'd still be turning over in his grave, probably. All I did that had anything to do with women or feminism, I changed the examples in my dissertation from using men to using women. Like Charles de Gaulle to Golda Meir is one that's in my head still. I don't know what the example was, but I went on the job market sooner than was ideal, because then husband Bill wanted to go to law school. And so I only applied around commuting area of where he'd applied to law schools. And it was much easier for me to get a job in California, either northern or southern, than it was in New England. Schools in Connecticut and Massachusetts don't hire from the University of Maryland, at that time, at least. Trinity College, that was then all men, even wrote me a letter, again, after the Civil Rights Act. This would have been 68, 69. "Surely I must not understand that they are a men's college and do not hire women." I did then. But fortunately, I had some offers from Cal State campuses, and I went to Cal State in LA, which most of you know is in East LA. I had never been west of Colorado. I didn't even realize I was an Anglo. And I wondered how I'd ever get any work done with all that sunshine and those palm trees. I'm going to say more later about teaching at Cal State, LA. But at first, again, it was a big change. I had just turned 26 as I began to teach that fall in 69. Cal State LA was already on a sort of leading edge of racial, ethnic, mixed, working class students. It was a year of great student protest all over the country. You know, Kent State was in that academic year. And in East LA, it was a really exciting time of upheaval for Chicanos, which I knew nothing about since I didn't even know I was an Anglo. But I learned, you know, very fast. The luckiest part of my job was Sharon Bishop. I was her colleague. I got to tell you, I don't know how we would have gotten through this without each other. But they had hired her 2 years before at Cal State LA, and she had, quote, worked out so they could hire another one. And the men were all, well, the youngest one was about 15 years older than I was, and they went up from there. Of course, they called us girls, though I'm sure we did look like girls to them. You know, we were a lot younger. They would joke with us, all in good spirits. You're castrating me. But as long as we kept our sense of humor, it was okay. There was one guy who couldn't even remember there were two of us. He would start a conversation with me, and he'd pick it up with Sharon the next day. Now, in fairness, we do vaguely look alike as a type, right? But anyway. But we did, I mean, it was great. We carpooled from Santa Monica to East LA, we commiserated, we strategized about teaching and writing and university politics in the world, and we played tennis and skied. And frankly, we transformed the department. We tried to make sure that the department became more diverse in terms of philosophical approaches, gender identity, sexual orientation, and at least some ethnic diversity, but it isn't enough. And then our new colleagues helped us make it even, you know, a nicer, better place. Unfortunately, five of us who provided some diversity retired, and several others left. And they've had a hard time hiring. Universities are like that. But back to 1969. I was hired to do epistemology, metaphysics, philosophy of mind. I was to replace Hospers. Remember John Hospers? Yeah, anybody? Okay, well, anyway, at the time he was very well known. He had just moved from Cal State LA to USC. I taught those courses, and along with, you know, 20th century history of analytic philosophy and Wittgenstein and logic and intro. Now, how did it get to feminism? I started putting things in my courses, little at a time. I found a partial syllabus from a course in January 1971. I need to clean my files out, clearly. I used Eleanor Kuykendall's Philosophy in the Age of Crisis, which was a new book that was relevant, which is what people wanted then. It wasn't feminist. It was an anthology, you know. I know that I used Kant and Sartre on sex, and Tom Nagel's article, which came out in 69 on sexual perversion, which is not feminist at all, but it's as relevant as we could get then. and I read Marcuse and Fanon alongside Hobbes and Rousseau. Sharon and I made illegal copies of Judy Thompson's A Defense of Abortion just as soon as it came out in 1971. And I immediately started teaching this new course we created, Contemporary Moral Problems, and that's where you get the feminism in. I did feminist stuff, I did sex and love, I did bioethics. It wasn't until 75 that I taught my first full course that was feminist, and it was a special topics, you know, I do a special topics first. And I used John Stuart Mill, Harriet Taylor Mill, Simone de Beauvoir, Shulamith Firestone, and some articles from Carol Gould's issue of Philosophical Forum, which came out in 73-74. Some of my older male colleagues said it would never get past the college curriculum committee because it wasn't universal and objective. But I knew who was on the committee. There was a feminist sociologist and a feminist psychologist. It passed. Yeah. About the same time, I got an invitation from Dick Wasserstrom to comment at a group meeting at the APA here on this coast on a paper of Fred Berger's on pornography and censorship. So I had to figure out what bothered me so much about Fred's paper when I disagreed even more with the conservatives who he was attacking. But I figured it out. And that led to my first feminist publication, Pornography and Respect for Women in Social Theory and Practice in 1978. And it was reprinted in so many anthologies that guys at APA meetings would see my name tag, and from wholesome students to these creepy professors, they'd come and say, "Oh, you're the Ann Gary who wrote on pornography." sorry, I lost my place. They invaded my personal space. That's how I have it written down. I didn't have and Lear. So I knew that my mother would just be horrified to know that I was identified in any way with pornography. And so I never showed her the paper. I never told her about the creeps or anything. And also, I wanted to move on from the topic, even independently of my mother, because I had no taste for arguing in public. It was a nasty time. I don't want to argue with Catherine McKinnon, you know, views publicly and, you know, be attacked and stuff. So I never agreed to publish anything on it, but finally in 2000, when people were still wanting to reprint this 1978 article, I did revise it to take into account a few of the things that had been happening in the intervening time. And it had as a new title now, Sex, Lies, and Pornography, or sometimes Sex, Lies, and Respect. Pacific SWIP I'm turning to next. I think it was a little later than 72. I think it was the fall of 74. Jackie Thomason, who will figure in a lot of activities here, Sharon and I, and our then partners or spouses, were at Sharon's house, a dinner party. Remember those? We had dinner parties. And Jackie had come from UMass Amherst, where they had already begun to have SWIP meetings. And she thought we should start having them on the West Coast. And so we did. I mean, this is one of those, well, we need to do it. Let's do it. And so I hosted the first one at my house in February of 75. People slept over at my house or with other attendees. Jackie's husband, Jeff Sika, provided childcare. And it kept going. The Claremont students, led by Terry Wynant, hosted the next meeting that spring. And then I don't know remember the order, but San Francisco State had it, Stanford had it, came back to Marjorie Weinzweig's home in LA, and I know that because Helen was there giving a paper on pornography. And I even know when it is because I just had a kid and I had to bring him to the 78. We used to, in the early days, we would have a meeting in Southern California in the spring and then somewhere else in the fall, but that became unsustainable. It's just, you know, a lot. We did not have the kinds of controversies that the other divisions of SWIP had. Lesbian, not currently lesbian, do we let men in, things like that. I would come back and talk about these things. I'd hear about them from people in other divisions at APA meetings or something, and they'd say, "It's the Pacific laid back, you know." Well, We actually always allowed men to attend, and we didn't have any sort of gay straight splits at all. So, but even though we allowed men to attend, not that many men ever did. But at one early meeting at my house, Marilyn Pearsall, one of the men, maybe two at most, were there to leave the room. One man objected. He was one of my students who was called himself a feminist anarchist, but the emphasis was on anarchist. I convinced him to leave. I don't know how. And then he came back. You know. At the Stanford meeting, again, Jackie Thomason, I gave an early paper, early version of my paper on pornography, and she had a John Holmes movie. You can Google him, too. And so we showed the John Holmes movie, and then I did my paper on pornography and respect for women. We got the equipment, of course, from Stanford. I don't think Stanford ever knew that we were showing pornography with their equipment. We also had parties at APA meetings. And in order to come to a party, you had to be a member or an associate member. So we let men be associate members and took their money, and they could come to the party. And we made money. We had jewelry, we had pins, merch. We had merch. But it was really exciting intellectually. That kind of early days, when you're rethinking anything and everything you want to in philosophy, examining all the assumptions we could think of at the time, whether this or that was appropriately called philosophy, whether philosophy simply needed to be redone, that's one of my early talks. A little grandiose. let's see if we got here. And I know that people who are members of other groups who are outsiders and marginalized in this discipline, well, you'll know what I mean. It's a heady time. It's really important for when you are on the outside to be, you know, upfront and tough in your early fights for your own voices, for making sure that your issues are, whether it's race, ability, gender, class, sexual orientation, being trans, are heard as philosophically significant issues. We also fought against institutional discrimination of various kinds and worked with the APA Committee on Women, Status of Women. And importantly, we conceived of having a SWIP Journal of Feminist Philosophy. The East Coast, you know, SWIPers also had that idea. Again, it's Jackie Thomason came forward because she knew more about beginning a journal than the others of us did, because some of her analyses did some kind of publishing. So our division of SWIP consulted with the others about the idea. Yeah, everybody liked the idea, but it wasn't happening. And so somehow, and I want to ask Helen about this actually, our informal group in Pacific asked Jackie and me to form an editorial board, or else we just did it. I think we were asked though. And so we called for nominations and applications, and we got all these CVs, and we tried to balance it by geography. We literally had them out on the floor, geographically, and who was lesbian and who was straight, and whether you were really radical or just kind of liberal, and whatever else we needed to take into account at the time. We didn't manage to get a good representation of women of color, but we did always have one, at least one, on the board. Let's see. What else did we do with the balancing? That was it, I guess. I assume we proposed all the names to all the U.S. divisions of SWIP, but I don't really have any memory of that. I hope we did, but we might have just announced it. In any case, it worked out. The board started to write letters to each other. Remember letters? male, and we had an occasional meeting. We invited Aziza Al-Hibri to become the first editor, and the first two issues were published inside Women's Studies International Forum, starting in 1983. So it took a while for it to happen. But there was a lot more going on in the 70s, too. We had a women's caucus that began meeting in the spring of the Pacific APA of 73. You might say that's the inception of SWIP, but we didn't have a name yet or anything for it. I happened to be on the program committee that year, so we just put it in there. The APA Committee on the Status of Women was active. I joined it in 75 with Allison, Marilyn Fry, Jane English, Linda McAllister, and Merrill Province Hentica. Half of them dead, unfortunately. The other half of us fortunately alive. but what was happening, feminism, feminist philosophy was building from the ground roots in many places in the world. On this continent, it grew from one little shelf. I used to have one little shelf of feminist books to and articles, to a full philosophical field with a great amount of wonderful work. And just attending meetings today and looking at the books, wonderful what's going on. Now, what else was I doing for the last 50 years here? No, I already did the first 10, I guess. Well, first of all, I got divorced. I married Bob Ashen, the aforementioned copyright lawyer. inherited two stepchildren and had a baby. But in terms of work, the first and most time-consuming thing I did was teach a really large number of students. We who teach in the Cal State system will know what I'm talking about. We have an unconscionably large teaching load, and of course it's harder on faculty who are just part-time temporary than those of us on tenure track. My department has an MA program, undergraduate major minor with multiple options, and when we were on quarters, the teaching load was three courses a quarter, and if you received a course off, it was for doing something that took work. I love to see the face. That's the layout. That's what it feels like. like if you're department chair, you get a course off. Well, you get two for department chair, but chair a university-wide committee revising the general education program, teach a large lecture managing TAs, for that you get a course off. But I really want to speak a little about what it's like to teach in, well, it's called a comprehensive university, but it's really, it's the people's university. Yeah. Because to my knowledge, I'm the first Dewey lecturer that's come from those of us who do that. I really learned a lot from my students. They're from all over the world. They have, you don't have to make up cases for moral conflict. They've lived them. They learn to speak from their own lives, which are usually very different from the lives of the people who teach them, if we ask them. And then we have to listen to what they say. They are not privileged people, nor are they usually 18-year-olds who don't know why they're in college. They take higher education very seriously. They're primarily working class. They were first gen before first gen was a term. Almost all people of color, now at Cal State, LA, primarily from homes in which English isn't the first language. I mean, where they don't even speak English at home, and lost my place. And they're primarily transfers from the two-year colleges. They don't feel entitled. You have to convince them to come to your office hours, talk to you even when it's not a dire emergency. They often have to fight against their parents or other family members in order to even major in philosophy. Some refuse to declare it until the last minute so their parents won't know. But they are, I taught what became the capstone course, and in it, the students had to reflect both in the group orally and in writing about how they'd changed over time, you know, from the courses they took and how they rethought things. And they went, as a lot of students do, from the sort of uncritical acceptance of authority, the priest, the parent, the teacher, to a self-reflective knowing what their values are and hoping they can live them in their lives. And it's a pleasure to teach them. Not every single minute, but on the whole, it really was a pleasure to teach them. I enjoyed teaching at other more cushy, you know, places like, you know, the University of Tokyo and in Hungary and Canada and other places in the U.S., but I never felt like I was wasting my time at Cal State LA. And teaching there also helped me tremendously as someone who's white. Not only were the students mostly people of color, but as we created the programs on campus in the 70s, women's studies, the Women's Resource Center, workshops for tenure and promotion for women and stuff, I was always working with women of color. And so it took me a long time to understand why some white feminists were worried about women of color undermining feminist theory. It just didn't make sense to me because my daily experience working in a mixed racial ethnic environment, you're practicing your feminism with lots of different women and you're doing it for and on behalf of all sorts of women. So I never got what the issue was. Well, ultimately I did get it, but. Okay, moving on to things more painful to me, writing. Some people can manage their lives very well. They can write each day, but I'm not one of them. I have to have a clean, my head has to be clear. I wrote during breaks, or if I had to give a talk during the term, I would, you know, you do it. I second guess everything I write, you know, to this day. By the time I finish a paper, I think anyone could have written that. But years later, when I look at it again, I think, I like that. And I usually think I was right. I was once introduced at a conference as somebody who'd written on an amazing number of topics. And my response, and it was quite serious, was, I have a really short attention span. I can't keep it on one thing, in one area, and it's certainly too short to write a whole book. I would get files of papers I didn't finish, as well as talks I didn't turn into papers, and they'll probably stay that way. Fairly soon, certainly by the early 80s, I stopped even trying to do things that weren't feminist. I just couldn't sustain an interest in writing about my earlier topics. So I went on to write about what's philosophically interesting about love and sex, pornography, abortion, narcissism and vanity, implications of caring about gender for philosophical methods and stuff like that. But all the while, I was worried about having clean tools, in quotes, okay? I was haunted by Audre Lorde's, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. Were we kidding ourselves that we could even do this? I was worried about being in the grip of a misleading picture that was male-biased and falling prey to a male-biased conjuring trick, to get a little Wittgenstein in here. On the other hand, the unexamined life is not worth living. That's also in there. And we were certainly examining the most fundamental assumptions of human lives, at least we thought we were. And all the disciplines have been the master's tools, but we have to start somewhere. We also speak natural languages that are usually under male authority, but we need to speak something. I mean, we've really used the works of men, both living and dead, in very creative sorts of ways. One recent example that I'm going to take something from toward the end of the talk is Mariana Ortega's reading of Heidegger in light of her concerns of intersectionally marginalized people. I mean, she uses Heidegger to help her make sense of how the multiplicitous self, well, that's all I'll say, how it exists. Let's see. Oh, I forgot to check the time. Oh, no, I got to keep going. Okay, I'm going to skip some things here. So I was worried about philosophical methods in general, but I was particularly worried about analytic philosophy. It's my home ground, but it's a contested ground about which I have personal conflicts. So finally, in 1995, I published A Minimally Decent Method, Analytic Philosophy and Feminism. And I still like the questions I ask. I had to look them up, of course, but by which to determine if it is a method that can be used by women or any group that is marginalized. So let me give you a taste. Do its goals or objectives? I'll give you a taste if I can read it. Do its goals or objectives lead to social change? Does it formulate issues, questions, and theories that encourage a wide range of points of view? Whose interests guide its choice of questions and theories? Are its strategies compatible with a vast array of styles of learning, of justification, and decision-making? Are its central concepts and assumptions deeply and in continuing ways gender-biased? Does it allow for marginalized people to be recognized authorities? Can it be helpful in evaluating feminist-motivated research? Are its criteria and success and failure appropriate for feminist goals? Of course, if I were doing it over, I'd reword some of the questions, and I'd think differently about some of the answers. I wasn't yet concerned with trans people or the whole range of options in gender that are important to how we now think about gender. Nor was I thinking about the deep implications of Eurocentrism, you know, colonialism, things like that. The kind of diversity I was concerned with was racial, ethnic, ability, sexual orientation, gender, identity, and class. And even with those kind of diversities, if I were writing now, it would be doing it in some kind of intersectional way. But so I've been writing about intersectionality. I've been written more about analytic feminism, including a recommendation that we not divide feminists so much by method, that we de-emphasize that. A very nice editor who was doing an anthology on analytic feminism wanted me to write a paper. I said, yeah, but I'm going to argue against having, you know, these lines drawn, and she let me do it, so I did. Now, in contrast, and this is where I can hop through some of it faster because of all that Allison said, I don't agonize as much when I'm editing. I just agonize if it's my work, right? You get to read all these articles and call it work, and you get to help people improve them, and so Well, and you're putting, this occurred to me this afternoon too, you're putting people in conversation with each other, and you are telling the field, yes, Marilyn Fry is doing metaphysics, yes, Maria Lugones is doing philosophy of mind, and if you time it right, whether intentionally or by luck, you help shape the field. You shape other people's classes. At least you did back in the days when students bought whole books. And I really enjoyed editing books. The Hypatia issue that I mentioned I did with Talia, I learned so much from Talia Betcher. She's one of my colleagues. And it was so much fun reading all this new work from people. They were all young, too, the authors. So then, when when I was asked to do the Rutledge Companion, they wanted, what they had in mind was sort of analytic feminism and history. And I said, no. It's got to be more inclusive than that. And so I did ask Allison Stone and Sereen Cotter to edit it with me. And as Allison pointed out, it was very good timing because that book came out in 17. Also in 17, the Hypatia thing happened, the crisis after the publication of Tuvel's A Defense of Trans Racialism, that where everybody resigned. And they needed a new editor. And I never wanted to edit Hypatia. I wanted it to exist. You know, that's what I wanted. But when the nonprofit board chair called me in July 17 to ask if I would take over editing duty, my first response was, I'm a cis white woman. I don't think I'm the one you need. But then I remembered that I really do want Hypatia to continue to exist. And so I said, let me see if Allison and Sereen will do it with me, because we had a great working relationship. We trusted each other, and they did. But I agreed to take the lead on problems. Fortunately, we didn't have too many. But we did not know what was going to happen. It was a very tough time. We didn't know what would transpire. People were very angry, most notably women of color, you know, trans people and allies. Submissions went down overnight. We had to reestablish trust between among all the various, you know, constituencies, I guess the word would be. But, you know, when you're retired from teaching, you can turn your life around on a dime if you have to. And, you know, I couldn't argue with them. I mean, even though I was white and cis, I had been involved with Hypatia forever. And I'd been on the editorial board, whatever kind, nonprofit, associate editors, and so forth. In fact, Allison said, what? Oh, dear. Oops, I got two more pages. But it worked. In short, it worked. We did build Hypatia back up. We found a wonderful team at University of Oregon that was extremely diverse. They took over in 2019 and pursued a lot of interesting things. And now we're looking for a new team already. Before I move to the last part of it, I want to say something about the APA, because it's been such a good part of what's changed. I was a student at the University of Maryland when the APA formed its first national office in the late 60s. Alan Pash was a good friend of mine. He was the first executive director, and his only salaried assistant was his wife, Ellie Pash. And the early experience led me to have a kind of loyalty to the APA that and an interest in working to improve it, that some people of my generation, you know, feminists of my generation, don't share. And I was put to work really quickly when I moved out here. It was tokenism, right? Take the girl, I heard they said the program committee consisted of three people. It wasn't such a large thing yet, but three of us. So, well, they took the girl, me, put me on the program committee, but the girl had to read all the papers the men did, right? So it was a lot of work. But, and they put us on all three of us were on exec too. And some of them were not prepared for the girl. Oliver Johnson, who was then secretary treasurer, at some meeting, I don't know what I'd said, he said, now listen, girly. yeah. And I know, and Allison pointed out that I commented on a paper of hers, Can Men Teach Feminism, in 1976. And they gave me a choice of two papers that year. So I know there were at least two that year. But a lot's changed. The staff, the officers, the committee structure, the membership, the kinds of work they do, those who get chosen for awards, persistent, if small, but persistent funding of a lot of work for various marginalized groups, and not just with those categories that are for marginalized groups. Even other categories get applied. So thank you to all of you who've worked at various times over the years, you know, for that, because it's hard work. So now, on to the future. There's so much negative right now that I want to skip. All the humanities are having a hard time, a lot of problems in the professions, in the academy. I want to just set those aside and talk about what we can do to improve philosophy. I couldn't have imagined when I got my PhD in 1970 all that we'd be doing today. It was unimaginable, just going to sessions, looking at books. I didn't think of it. And so I want to say, well, what will we be doing in 50 years? And we just don't know. But let's think about it briefly. What we can do to help ensure that it'll keep improving. There was a question that I'm going to paraphrase of Christy Dotson in 2012. Can philosophy and the philosophical climate be good enough for us? Okay. Her us goes beyond the categories of race, class, gender, ability, and stuff. She's including Eastern philosophers, public philosophers, and a lot of others. And she's correct that policing the boundaries of the discipline with the culture of justification and legitimation has a very wide impact. But for this talk, I don't want to go all the way there, but just keep on the categories that usually go into thinking and intersectionally. Consider that in this century, there still have to be papers written. How is this paper philosophy? Or that's not philosophy. First was Christy Dotson, second was Catherine Jenkins. So drawing on their work and a lot of others, let me cut to the chase. We have to stop trying to police the boundaries of the discipline by demanding that people justify why their work is philosophical. I think it's our worry about who gets in the door, who gets across the border, is due to fear that they might shake up our conceptual schemes too much, our frameworks, our epistemology in ways that scare us. But I want my frameworks and my methods shaken up. I want more of us to realize that we need to learn more from those being excluded, because we don't even know what we don't know or what philosophy could become. We're really good, we think, at examining other disciplines' assumptions, but we need to be better able to examine our own and to understand what we take for granted. So, we verbally acknowledge, yes, it's Eurocentric, but we don't understand the implications of being Eurocentric. We don't see where or how deep the tentacles of colonialism go, at least I don't. We need help. So when we talk about diversifying the demographics of philosophy, we're thinking not only about behaving with justice and respect to potential colleagues and students, we're also acting in the long-term interest of our discipline. So I want a coalition that's going to enable us to drop our defensiveness and open up the discipline. All of us in dominant groups need to listen carefully to those who've been excluded, to their experiences, their lives and values, the concepts they would use, how they would frame the issue, how they'd sketch out a whole area of philosophy. What does their version of non-ideal look like? What philosophical methods and practices should be? Who should be counted as authorities, and lots of other things? And this coalition, we need to keep reminding ourselves that we don't know what we don't know, and we don't know what we could become. And we might be inclusive in conversations, pluralist in our methods, open-minded, and open to just rethinking anything. And these will be exciting philosophical conversations. I'm going to skip a little bit here. This is going on longer. Let me just go to Ortega. I mentioned before she's using Heidegger some. Her 2016 book, In Between, she says she wants to lay out the ways philosophy both negates me and gives me new ways to see, to understand, to feel, to be. She speaks about the fact that the modern self of philosophy and the abstract individual don't fit herself at all. Herself is a multiplicitous self, and so are a lot of other people's. Now, when I read people like Ortega and Lugones, who I didn't give you her quotation, and others, I have to reread them and reread them because my own framework is so deeply embedded in me that I access their points and then it slips away. And I can't help thinking other members of dominant groups do that too. So we need this coalition, people, to keep at us, the ones of us who are in, dominant groups. We need to learn from our colleagues in lots of disciplines, from literature, from students and others with whom we interact, who have other kinds of experience, whether lived or academic, and to teach us not to push away the details of other people's experiences and their insights. I do want to read one very short quotation from Ortega. As philosophers, do we lack the disposition to understand each other's way of life? If we do, let's remember Patricia Hill Collins' call for intersectional, critical, and constructive project. Let's remember Ansel Dua's creative mestizaje. Let's reconstruct the way we do philosophy. Let's drop the false idols and break the imposing statues that are the gatekeepers. And let's ignore the empty promises of justice and neutrality and not allow those who have no disposition for understanding each other's way of life to define what really should be a love of wisdom and not of exclusion. That's it.